Now, Dr. Joan Kenley, psychologist and author of Whose Body Is It Anyway, brings you Conversation Radio.
It's try to ignore that it means more than that. Oh, what's love got to do with it? What's love but a second-hand emotion? What's love got to do with it? Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken?
Hello, I'm Joan Kenley, welcoming you to The Joan Kenley Show, bringing you Conversation Radio, a program where talking really matters. And this week our theme is What's Love Got to Do With It, which will focus on what detours relationships can take and what to do to make a long-lasting relationship not only last, but flourish, all of which I think can be interesting to the singles in our audience who may be between relationships. We're going to talk later in the show about finding love in the 21st century, if that's what you're hoping for. We're so delighted to have our wonderful guests, Ed McClune and Dr. Brenda Wade, who's been with us for our shows on intention and soul purpose, which you can find in our archived shows on my website, joankenley.com. Dr. Wade is a San Francisco-based psychologist, author, television host, and producer. National audiences know Brenda from her syndicated TV program, Can This Marriage Be Saved?, her PBS shows, and her recent guest appearance on The Today Show. She is also a regular host on the Bay Area TV show Black Renaissance. Her books are Power Choices, Signposts on Your Journey to Wholeness, Love, Joy, and Peace, and Love Lessons, A Guide to Transforming Relationships, and What Mama Couldn't Tell Us About Love. And we have Ed McClune. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist specializing in couples counseling. He also works as a supervising process teacher for the Hoffman Institute, teaching relationship intensives throughout the country. Formerly a host for the KBLX show, The Quiet Storm, Ed now maintains a private practice in Marin and Sonoma, where he currently lives with his family. From Tina Turner's opening song, there are lyrics that say, "What's love but a sweet old-fashioned notion? Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken?" Well, we all have hearts, so there's no choice about not having a heart. But I'd like to open the conversation about the main reasons for heartbreak, short or long-term. Brenda, what are your thoughts? What does break our hearts?
I think the most important thing, Joan, because that question really sent me into a little trip down memory lane when my heart was broken. And I think it's not getting love back from someone we love. Mm. I mean, it's that simple. Mm-hmm. I remember being deeply in love with someone, and out of the blue, he broke off the relationship, and I was devastated. And of course, I look back now, and, you know, with the hindsight, 2020, I go, wow, thank God. You know, I didn't
yes,
marry that person.
He was a
great guy, but I needed to be on a different path, because where we didn't sync up was the area that's most important to me, and that's spiritual transformation and growth, and we didn't sync up there.
Well, that's a good thing then.
So I think for most of us, when we are in love and we, you know, the old unrequited love, that is the most painful thing.
Someone just unilaterally taking away our dream or our possibility.
That's a great way to frame it. It is also the deepest hurt we can have in the heart is to be rejected for who we think we are. And, you know, pain is not good, but you can learn from pain, don't you think, Ed?
Well, absolutely. I certainly have. And whether we stay in the relationship or not, there's going to be pain involved.
Yeah.
And heartbreak is the ultimate pain. But even just moving with the little hurts of being disillusioned through the course of a relationship and staying committed, that's what really, you know, the transformation you're talking about, Brenda, really is the gift of the transformative power of committed love.
Right. And I think young people or people who aren't sophisticated about relationships fall into traps that they could be saved from if they just could listen to this radio show first or read one of the books that we've talked about first, because there are little ways and clues to be awake to if you've had that chance to really study relationship and what can take you off the path and also what can bring you back on.
And there's no question about what you're saying, Joan. The research actually shows that we'd have a 2/3 lower divorce rate if people would just do premarital counseling before they get married. And I mean, one of my favorite little soapboxes to get on is that you actually have to pass a test to get a driver's license. What about that marriage license?
There you go.
You know, when are we going to have to actually know something and have some skill before we get married? And it would save people endless heartache. And I actually met someone, the only person I have ever met, who is this great communicator, came in with the person he was going to marry, and I said, where did you learn to communicate like this? He said, oh, I'm from Providence, Rhode Island, and in our school system, we actually had a program, an actual program on how to be in a healthy relationship.
I am stunned and oh so pleased to hear that
yes.
that happened. Lovely.
We need that all around the country, not to mention the rest of the world.
Way back when, I had a household class that I took in eighth grade that trained me how to fix a toilet and sew a little bit and a few other things. And of course, by the time I had my own toilet to fix, I'd forgotten because eighth grade was too soon to do that. But a relationship class, a marriage class, and some kind of guideline to sign up for before you get married, I think is a really good idea. What are your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've been sort of repeating this line about serial disillusionment. And if we go into relationship with this sort of fantasy, the innocent dream of it's all going to be, someday my prince will come, then we're setting ourselves up just to be disappointed.
Sure.
And then that mini heartbreak happens. A lot of times we think, oh, the relationship's over, I've picked the wrong man. You know, I hear this a lot in women clients that I have, is some reason I keep attracting unavailable men, which is a story in and of itself.
Well, it is, because that's their intention isn't to find an available man, but they are not aware of that.
It's also that it's harder for men to be available. You know, there's a cultural norm here that we're fighting, and I find that for a lot of heterosexual couples, they really bump up against this cultural wall. And I often say to women, look, who's got all the emotional equipment? You've got more oxytocin, you've got estrogen, you've got this great big fat emotional side of your brain that men don't have. The equipment's bigger in women. Why would you want somebody who's not equipped to be in the driver's seat on the emotional side? Get in the driver's seat on the emotional side and don't ask me, why do I have to do it? Well, it's because you're the woman and by God, you're equipped and use the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Use it, but use it skillfully, not to bash the guy, why aren't you more like me, but to invite this emotional connection if we really work at it and keep it strong. Here's where the juiciness is.
And in a sense, again, using the sort of stereotype, is we're not all of, as men, we're not all of that available to ourselves. We haven't had that introspective look at tuning into emotions. What is that? It's not what we're expected to do. And so part of the gift of being in a relationship with as a woman is you're helping coach me be more intimate with myself so that I can actually have a conversation with you about something other than sports and the stock market.
Well,
and it's not all bad for women either. It's not a bad bargain to learn how to ask for what you want without it being negative, critical, or in some way demeaning. I had a guy come in last week who just started living with the love of his life, and she took him around the house and showed him everything he'd done wrong. And it was a laundry list of things that went on and on. By the time she was done, he was furious with
her.
And he came in for his therapy session and said, all right, I just have to know straight up, was she wrong or am I right? That was not cool. I said, it wasn't cool. It was definitely not cool. He said, okay, how many of those does she get? I said, maybe one a week. Because any more than that, instead of her looking for what's good and what's right and how generous and kind you're being, she's tearing you down. So he went home and said, you get one a week.
Right. Well, you know, when we say what's love got to do with it, it is the container, which we've talked about before, but we have to look at what brings that container to the foreground. And I know that there are retreats that couples can have where everybody sits in a circle and you talk about what you feel and what you love about relationship. And it seems to bring the men more into the vocabulary of what women want to share and hear.
Yes.
And it's a really stimulating thing. I've been in some of them myself. And then sometimes there are little groups that meet and like each other in these seminars who then say, let's just get together at our house and have a day-long conversation about what's up for us now.
No.
And
yeah.
It makes it much more permissive than just two people talking about what's up for us
Joan,
now.
What you're saying is so crucial because we spend a lot of time. Couples will get together and say, hey, have you got any stock tips? Or, hey, how about the Niners? Or we talk about anything except our intimate relationship. And by just having the conversation, what are you guys working on and how are you doing with it? Have you got any tips for us? It takes relationship out of that. It's behind the closed bedroom door and you can't talk about it, to, hey, let's help each other with it.
Exactly. You don't need a facilitator. You don't need a therapist. You just need the intention to be kind and purposeful and curious and interested in what's going on and what can help the whole container of relationship.
You're creating a 21st century extended family. You know, we don't have grandma and parents, but, you know, creating that for yourself. Mm-hmm. That's a great idea, Brenda.
Well, it's Joan's idea. I like it, Joan.
Yes. Yeah. So as we wrap up this segment about what we can do to refresh and revitalize our relationships, Eric Segal, author of the famous book and movie Love Story, said true love comes quietly, without banners or flashing lights, even if they really are there in the beginning. But we have to move beyond those flashing lights, and we have to look at what is going to be the illusion and delusion about love. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about all of these things. So keep listening. We'll keep talking.
You found it, and it's different. The Joan Kenley Show.
When first we kissed, blame it on my youth. If only just for you, I did exist. Blame it on my youth. I believed in everything.
What's not to love about the Joan Kenley Show, where talking truly matters.
Hello, I'm Joan Kenley, and you're back with the Joan Kenley Show, where we're focusing today on what's love got to do with it in relationship detours and all kinds of other illusion and delusion parts of romance? We're joined by Ed McClune and Brenda Wade, who both specialize in couple counseling. So let's continue with this illusion-delusion subject for a while because there's more to say.
One of the things we haven't touched on yet that's crucial, and I have my little three-step formula that I talk about in love lessons, also just not to throw all these books at her, but in Power Choices, that we have to be clear going in who we are and what we bring to the table.
Sure.
So my first chapter in Power Choices is investigation. Who am I? Where do I come from? Whose patterns am I most likely to replicate? So I actually have people go through a genogram and go back as far as they can in their families and trace the relationship patterns. What kinds of disappointments? What kinds of roles? So they can look at the beliefs and the myths in the family. One person I worked with recently was stunned to find that there was a belief that men will never stick around. So her pattern is she gets in a relationship instantly. Instant relationship. From the moment she meets the guy, she has some kind of little checklist in her head. Okay, this will do. We're going to have sex tonight.
Oh, my.
First night, because it's not going to last anyway. So why should I invest any time or trouble? And of course, that's a formula to make that old pattern from the family true.
Well, for sure. And there are other women who think that every man they meet is in love with them, but they don't find themselves in any relationship. So there's a delusional way to look at love, too,
Yes. Is
to fantasize that there is all this love coming at you when, in truth, nothing's happening.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of whatever that magic of chemistry of attraction. You know, even family negative patterns of the past somehow are incorporated into a room full of 30 attractive people. Why is that one suddenly I'm drawn to?
Yes.
And so it's, you know, for me, it's doing, in a certain sense, what you were saying, Brenda, incorporating consciousness. like not letting chemistry override my decision making.
Exactly.
I'm shopping. I have to be an informed shopper. Let chemistry draw me in, perhaps, but
sure.
keep my wits about me as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, the head and the heart. And often I have women say to me in particular, well, but my heart knows he's the right one. I said,
oh, give it up.
Honey, use your head. Get right. your head in the act here, because if you don't stop and think, first of all, what's my pattern? Is this a match for my pattern? Even if it is a match and I'm deeply in love, I've got to manage that and transform the pattern, or I'll end up with the same result. And then your head can say to you, you know what? Actually, if he's not calling me when he says he will, he's not showing up when he says, that's probably not somebody I can count on.
Right.
Even if the sex is mind-blowing.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes the most obvious things are put in the background because you just don't want to face the fact that this person isn't living up to your expectation.
Yes.
And a lot of it seems to collect around communication, expectations that aren't met or are met. Never talked about. And you, I'm sure you've heard, if love is the answer, can you please repeat the question? Right? But repeating a question is, if it's not the right one, may be not really the communication connector piece. Because if you ask the wrong question, you can push somebody away. We've heard so many times that if you want to get a man's full attention, ask him to do something. And that women in general are asking for more time to talk, speak of things relational, etc. But what are some of the communication no-nos that come up? I mean, money, maybe sex, power dynamics, parenting styles. Let's just jump into that pool.
I don't think there are any no-nos in terms of what you can talk about. I really believe the issue is how you talk about it.
Oh, it is. I mean, what people use as no-nos but shouldn't.
Ah, gotcha, Joan.
So meaning, in other words, people don't like to talk about money.
People
know?
Don't like
or
to
sex.
Talk about money. People don't like to talk about death. People don't like to talk about what you're going to do with the money if somebody dies.
Right.
Who's responsible for a breakdown?
Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, and the biggest, I find the biggest barrier to people talking about any of the tough topics, first of all, there's fear that if I talk about it, you won't like it and you will leave me or reject me.
Definitely,
but
that's
the other is people get into blaming, really quickly get into blaming, and not even realizing that they're blaming. Well, I'm talking about my feelings. I feel that if you do that, that's what I call the sneaky blame, as opposed to the out-and-out blame, which is, it's your fault.
Right.
I feel you're abandoning me.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. And that'll stop the energy right there, won't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's an accusation.
Yeah, exactly.
And
or an attack.
Yeah, so it's not an invitation to conversation.
It closes a door rather than opening one.
That was a hard one for me to learn, because I grew up in the school of, as long as you're not saying you and out-and-out blaming, you're just talking about your feelings. Did you see this study? It's called, Silence is Golden, that women can actually connect better with men if they use nonverbal connectors rather than verbal.
I have heard that.
Because
it
takes
really
out the blaming and the accusing.
Yeah, deeply looking in the eyes, caressing the head, holding hands as you go to the car, things like that.
Right. Women everywhere biting their tongues. All right.
Well, you know, men aren't so bristly that tenderness doesn't move us.
Exactly.
And because, you know, a lot of men will say, well, you can talk all about feelings, but how I judge you is how you act. What do you do? So, you know, we can have conversations forever, but how are you showing up? And sometimes a simple reaching out and just touching, talking about what are we going to do with the kids today, who's picking them up. I mean, it doesn't have to be a romantic conversation to have a romantic intention.
Well, for instance, we were spending Christmas with the French relatives in France this year, and my husband was across the table from me, and there were about 20 of us at the table, and he said out of nowhere, he said, don't you think Joan has a special glow about her this season? And I mean, it was just so wonderful to hear him say this
sweet.
Unexpectedly, you know. Not that he doesn't say things to me privately that are lovely, but to say this at the holiday table was just so heartwarming and so surprising people at Surprising moments is also a heart-opening thing
to do. That's actually one of, I call these little things love savers in the Love Lessons book. Yeah. I've got, my favorite love saver is along the lines of what you just said. Praise your mate, because when you put the P and the raise together, you get the power of raising the energy and the love if you're praising.
Right.
The other one I really like is be grateful for your mate. Remember when you didn't have one? Mm-hmm. Now you have one. It's like, the old ball and chain. Be grateful.
Well, you know, they say for a therapist, and we all have done therapy with people, that the major problem that comes in the door is, I don't have a relationship, or I've got a relationship problem.
Yes,
do hear many, many stories as we try to help people through their lives. Well, so, Ed, what are the major things that you find walk through the door? I mean, do you find that sexual issues or money problems or parenting styles are in the top of your lists?
What's your hit parade here?
Yeah,
well, power struggle. I mean, all of those kind of come under the power struggle and the resentments that build up about that. So over time, small disagreements, little bricks become big walls. And too often people come to counseling after those walls are pretty thick.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot, you know, people are entrenched in their separate camps.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of the base that I often use is to presume that the people come into my office because they have something in common, and that's they love each other.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the history that's put up these walls, there's this very powerful force in the room that if we can access and leverage, then we can start using that wall for something, not necessarily tearing it down, but to build something up next, to learn from and grow.
And what do you find is the length of time couples who are really committed to learning and changing have to spend with you for something transformational to happen?
I mean, that varies.
Of course,
three sessions to 3 years. A big piece of that is how do we put down our entrenched stands.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it takes a long time just to even know that I'm being stubborn.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
No, it's real.
Definitely.
I'm real that this is. You are that way.
And I'm right. I'm really right. And you, I wouldn't say wrong, but you're misguided.
And I'll tell you all the different ways you are.
Yes, right, thank you. Right. Thank you.
When you watch couples who are really committed, I often think that those who are willing to take the long haul of learning and growing together are going to have a really rich reward at the end of that trail.
Absolutely. There's no question about that, because going into a relationship, I think we start out with that fantasy and illusion we've talked about, but no one can prepare you or describe to you how rich it really gets after you've solved a few issues together, you've seen a few crises through, a few challenges through, and you've actually learned and grown as a human being. Because I call that the softening of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
The heart gets nice and soft because you've, in some cases, had to knead it and pummel it, maybe. But that softening of the heart allows us to actually increase our capacity to give and to receive love.
So it's not a weekend fix, though a weekend seminar can open up a whole large landscape of things to work on. Change takes time, and couples' relationships take time. And I want to take time here to bring up the subject of apology, and say that we can all benefit from remembering how a sincere apology can diffuse a stockpile of hurt and resentment in all kinds of relationships. But just because we want to make an apology doesn't mean we have taken the time to know how to do it most effectively. So, for instance, Beverly Engel, in her informative book, The Power of Apology, divides good apologizing into three parts she calls the three R's: regret, responsibility, and remedy. First, regret is a statement of sorrow for having caused discomfort or hurt. Second, responsibility, which is simply acknowledging your acceptance for your behavior without blame or excuses. And third, offering a remedy, a clear statement of your willingness to take action to heal the situation. So if you feel these ingredients make up a good guide for you, My suggestion would be to rehearse and practice expressing your regret, responsibility, and remedy a few times before you take the actual step to do it. Why? Because in the emotion of the moment, it's usually hard to remember a skill you've just learned. And once you've apologized well and experienced how powerful it can be, you will know how to use it appropriately when it's called for again. We'll be moving on to our next segment, speculating about what emotional fidelity is and isn't. And it's important to know the difference. You won't want to miss this part of our conversation with Brenda and Ed. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
The Joan Kenley Show. Talk radio your way. Dr. Joan Kenley, taking talk radio to the next level.
Hello, I'm Joan Kenley, welcoming you back to the Joan Kenley Show, where we're talking about what's love got to do with it, when relationships hit rough patches especially. And emotional infidelity can be a really tricky thing to handle. If there's not romantic intimacy, is it as damaging as an affair? Audience, what do you think? According to an AskMen.com dating survey, 74% of men think that cheating begins with a kiss. But women had a different opinion. They felt being unfaithful went beyond physical contact. They said a close friendship with the opposite sex, in which an intense and secretive emotional bond is formed, also counts as being unfaithful. So as we continue our conversations now with Dr. Brenda Wade, a San Francisco-based psychologist, author, television host, and producer, we will be talking about that as well. And we'll be joined by Ed McClune, a licensed marriage and family therapist and a supervising process teacher for the Hoffman Institute in San Rafael, which offers transformational seminars nationwide. I want to give an example of emotional infidelity, which I didn't have a clue about when I was in my 20s. I was very attracted to a young man who dated other women, but we became extraordinarily close friends. I mean, we had the best friendship. And he would tell every girl that he dated that I was the primary woman in his life, and not to be jealous and not to discount the fact that I was still going to be in his life. Well, this was a rotten thing to do to the women he was involved with sexually and romantically. And at the time, I didn't realize how these women must view me, and most of them I didn't meet. But that is a great example of someone just saying right away, I've got this other woman in my life, and take it or leave it. And that sort of made him unavailable in the long run, and he didn't get married till he was in his 50s.
Wow. So good story. That pretty much sums up emotional infidelity.
You know, it's how, in this sort of talk about romance, how can I be accountable to another person's heart?
Yeah.
And so it's an invitation to be as integrity with myself and with the other person. And you know, it's part of this shopping about who do I make commitments to. Mm-hmm. I'm learning more about, well, what's this person's level of integrity? How does he or she show up with, you know, congruent with what she says and what she'll do? And that's part of the heartbreak, is when we find out that these things I trusted weren't really so.
And betrayal can be just an enormous hurt when you trust someone. Just enormous. And I think the operative word in emotional infidelity is something that is intense And secretive.
And secretive.
Those are the operative words, I believe.
That makes it really tough if it's a secret, because then it's outside the relationship. And I call that an energy leak.
Mm-hmm.
Is you're siphoning energy out of the relationship. And if just think about siphoning it out of the gas tank of your car. The car is going to run out of gas, and the relationship will run out of gas.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real danger that people can't foresee. And often I've said, well, you know, it's not sexual. And, you know, I don't feel that way about them that I feel about you. But what they don't realize is that most partners who've got their wits about them can feel the difference. And attention is energy.
We
give our attention, we increase whatever it is we give our attention to.
In giving our spouse the permission to, if you will, pull in the reins. I had a couple who the husband was talking about a woman at work. And this set off the alarm bells in the wife, and she, you know, protested. Not knowing the relationship, not knowing a woman, and you know, the husband defended it. You know, she's a coworker. There's no big deal. It's not sexual. It's not anything. Eventually, the wife at, you know, a company function met the woman and was relieved that, no, this isn't his type. This wasn't going to happen. But just giving her the safety of knowing that when she felt an energy leak, she could protest and be heard.
Exactly. And I think that we spend so much time at work, those who go to an office to work, for instance, that it's natural that there would be collaborative partnership relationships and people that you are close to in conversation, and it's a passion that you're following to do the work that you do. But it is true that it can foster going over the line if it becomes exciting and creative to be with that person, and you come home, you're tired, and it's dinner and the kids, or no kids but a movie, and you haven't spent a lot of time investing your energy in what am I going to do creatively with my partner.
Yeah, that's actually pointing toward one of the really good fixes in a relationship, which is invest the relationship with the partner by shutting everything down and just sitting there for a few minutes. First of all, checking in, how are you, what are you feeling, what's going on in your life, but then quickly getting to what I call acknowledgments, so that you start putting the positive focus back in the relationship and raising again that level of esteem for one another.
Right, right. And so we're really coming down to fidelity in relationship is putting proactive, creative energy into relationship time.
Yes.
In other words, that's sort of a safety cocoon against these other things slipping into the relationship.
Right, and fidelity, having faith in my partner to maybe actually show things to me that I'm doing that I'm not aware that I'm doing that cause her pain.
Such a great point. But then let's move from the emotional infidelity idea to what happens when the partner does stray into a sexual relationship with someone else. Just what are the ways a couple can come back out of that?
You know, it's important to look here at intention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why am I in this relationship? What is it I want out of the relationship? Because if my intention is to grow, to learn, to be available, to, and I always say the standard for me, the gold standard, is how much am I learning about giving and receiving love? If I'm learning more about that cycle, giving and receiving, then I'm living the intention that I believe is the highest intention for relationships. I actually am working with someone who has affairs, and she thinks it's okay to do it as long as her husband doesn't know.
Uh-oh.
And when she travels for business, she says, well, it's a meaningless situation, and I'm away so much, and these are her exact words, I need to scratch the itch.
Oh, come on.
So, well, yeah, and so I said to her, you know, if you understand that everything is energy, I mean, it really is. How long can you keep taking the energy out of the relationship before he notices that you're not putting enough in to keep that relationship full, and it's going to collapse? And, of course, this person debates me vehemently that this is not so. He'll never. It's not what you know.
Mm-mm.
It's not what you know. It's what you feel, what you sense. And the invisible is real. And we eventually, of course, find out about the invisible being real just in how people feel about each other.
You bet.
So infidelity is a psychic, physical, and emotional trauma.
You bet.
And so if we hold it as that, trauma takes a long time to heal.
A very long time.
And so, you know, for the relationship, this relationship, or even a future one, because that trust is so traumatized, to grow, there has to be a willingness on the person who's had the affair to actually let that trauma heal over time. You know, it's such an ongoing confrontation of the shame that I've brought into our family that sometimes it's like, well, you get over it. Come on, it's over. I apologize. You know, it's been years.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, because it is a real and you know, emotional but also biological trauma.
Yeah.
Very much so. And in fact, I would have to say that there should be conversations between a couple about what if. Because I think sometimes there's an understanding that with the guy or the girl that, well, if he's away, I might have an affair, or if I'm in troubled times and I'm attracted to somebody, affair is probably okay, without delving into how traumatizing it can be. And unfortunately, there are couples counselors who actually say open marriage is okay.
It doesn't work. I mean, the research is in on that.
I mean, it really is. The research is in.
The people who wrote the book are divorced.
That's right.
I mean, it's again, you're taking the energy out, and sexual energy is powerful energy.
That's right.
And that's flowing out of the relationship. You can't expect that relationship to be as strong over time. We're talking over time. If you don't want that long-term relationship, then fine, that might work for you.
No, it's really true. And the truth is that when, I don't know, it was the 60s or something, open marriage, open relationship was a big thing with the flower children and Woodstock and all that kind of thing, free love, openness.
Right.
We can love everybody. There's no jealousy.
Well, it was an overcorrection because there had been too much repression, and we needed the overcorrection to get back to the middle. But I think we're swinging back to the middle now.
Oh, I totally agree.
I just wanted to piggyback on one thing quickly that Ed said about trauma. We now know that there are actual cardiac consequences for people
Without
who
question.
Go through psychological and emotional trauma. Cardiotoxins are very real.
I am so glad you brought that up, because we cannot want, if we love someone else, to put them in that kind of stress, that kind of position to heal from, which does take years and years to get over. And even if it doesn't come to mind, it is still in the body. So we have to honor that. And it's true, love is like heaven, but it can hurt like hell. But there's so much help these days and so many ways to heal broken hearts and broken relationships. Or if you're single, how to find a new relationship. You won't want to miss the rest of our conversation with Brenda and Ed. We'll be right back.
Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in.
Ready for more? Dr. Joan Kenley continues in a moment. Log on to joankenley.com, that's K-E-N-L-E-Y, to learn more and listen to archived shows.
In the evening breeze, listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in, just turn me loose, let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western skies.
Invite your friends and family to listen to The Joan Kenley Show.
Hello, I'm Joan Kenley, and you're back with The Joan Kenley Show, where the theme, What's Love Got to Do With It, now goes to the question, if you're single and pining for a relationship, what do you do? Well, first of all, I'll bring up the subject of the internet. There are over 800 internet dating sites, and 25% of Americans have visited them. In today's world, the internet does seem to be one of the best ways for singles to meet. And mature singlehood is at an all-time peak. There are millions of people over age 40 in the United States, and almost half are single. It seems if you're going to use the internet to find a match, you have to make it a major project in your life, much like the middle-aged woman we'll call Barbara. She can be described as a romantic who believed Mr. Right was out there on the internet. She's also a pragmatic, experienced woman who realized the road to Mr. Right would be paved with many emails and quite a few dates with Mr. Wrong. Her strategic internet plan was to send more than 80 emails in 80 days to men who were signed up on various matchmaking services, finding out in the process that she had to refine her own profile and learn to read others with a sharper eye. First, she just responded to people who were picking her, but once she learned to set more specific standards, her choices got better, and now she's dating someone she really likes. The idea here is that Barbara's commitment, systematic approach, patience, caution to meet in safe places, and a good sense of humor about it all really paid off. And she's just one of the many internet success stories we've heard about. And we're so happy to continue our conversation today with Ed McClune and Dr. Brenda Wade, both terrific specialists in relationship counseling. So, Brenda, what personal homework does a client need to look at when they're looking for love? What would you advise?
Well, not to sound trite, but the first place to look is inside.
There
you
go.
To really be clear about who you are, what you need. Again, we've got to do that investigation and use insight, use intuition, use all those tools and take those tools and apply them to ourselves first. If you come into a relationship and you've got all your issues and your stuff hanging out all over, that may lead to, okay, I found the relationship. See, it didn't work anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, you know, I brought my stuff to it and maybe if I've done some work, I'll have a better experience. So start with self, befriend yourself, fall in love with yourself, all of that. But again, I have to throw the caution in. Sometimes people say, well, I can't have a relationship because I've got too many issues. If that were the case, there would be no relationships.
Exactly.
So go right ahead and have one as bad as the rest of us.
Yep. Self-love may be the most attractive, non-purchasable commodity in the love market.
Oh, that's a great way to frame it.
Yeah,
oh, yes.
Oh, I like that. That's
so
good.
Then when we've got self-love in place, Ed, what do you think people can do who are single and want to find someone? What is the process that they need to go through in addition to what we're saying about, you know, safe places and places that, well, are more easy to find now than used to be? We don't have to go to a bar to find someone. We can go to our laptop computer, right?
Right. And that works.
It does.
As an old school guy, I'm actually really impressed about how much
I am too.
The service online actually works. You know, being careful.
Mm-hmm.
Careful with our heart. You know, that's part of the self-love is how much can I let out? How much can I invest in the other?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is my salvation. Never is that my salvation. And being interested, you know, is the person capable of being a learner? Which is also an admission that I don't know who this person is. To be a learner, I have to, you know, admit to incompetence or ignorance.
Or just being honest about the fact that you have to take time to learn about somebody, which is interesting that people on the internet dating services can email each other for a very long time before they even make a safe place to meet, which I think is a really good way to look at it.
We get closer that way.
Yeah.
And so what at the early stages of the relationship, we're starting to create a place where intimacy we're cultivating the land for intimacy rather than having all the emotional drive push us forward and get committed and then try to cultivate intimacy. So good conversation.
Right. And also, where there is an interest in a subject or a passion, there are places to go where people who have the same passion and the same interest show up. I know a person who loved wine, and she ended up marrying, in an adult education class, the wine professor. And so, you know, she followed her passion and found someone else who joined her
right.
in that. And
I know people who've met on triathlons.
Okay.
And biking expeditions, hiking expeditions. And I love that. Follow your bliss and whatever you're looking for will show up. But a lot of it, you know, the internet is the place because people delay getting married now. You're not going to get another pool of singles the way you did in college unless you go someplace with a great big pool like the internet. So being practical, I say to people, what would you do if you were looking for a job? You would get on the internet, you'd read the paper, you would network. You go to networking events and you would tell everybody you know, I'm looking for a job. follow those same steps if you're looking for a relationship, with the caveat that Ed and I are both saying the same thing, work on yourself.
Well, there's an astonishing story I have about a woman and man who did meet on the internet, and they used cameras, you know, to talk to each other, those little eyes above the screen, and they must have communicated for a year, and they decided to get married at Kinko's. They had never met. He was in one part of the country, she was in another, and so they had the cameras at Kinko's all set up some years ago, and they got married, and then he flew to be with her in California. So now that's probably the most unusual marriage story.
I would say it is. I'm not recommending it, but it's a great story.
I have met them, and they have a fabulous marriage.
Oh, wow.
That's a very interesting story, isn't it?
That is interesting. Well, so, who's to say? I'm not going to argue with that, Joan.
Not either.
Results.
But that's why we have to look at everything outside the box as possible.
Yeah. Well, the most important thing, again, for me is a relationship is a learning experience. And as a single, if you go in with that idea, Ed spoke about that a few minutes ago, go in with that idea, I am here to learn and I'm looking for the person who's willing to grow and learn with me, rather than, okay, do you have everything I need? Check, 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 check. Good. Got it all in the box. Wrap it up with a ribbon. I take it home only to discover later I have to do the growing anyway.
Yes,
if
indeed.
I want it to last.
And don't you find that in the seminars as well? You have the Hoffman Institute, which has a process, and you take it all over the country, and it talks about transformational possibilities for people and couples. And so do you find that couples come into these seminars when they're early in their relationship, in the middle of the relationship, or maybe in a more mature phase of the relationship?
Well, really in all phases of a relationship. But, you know, it is sad that most of the time what motivates us to grow is pain and suffering.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times people come into our offices or into the Hoffman process when there's some breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's painful and hopefully it's a really motivating place to do some deep, wonderful, growing work.
And so, Hoffman is one of the deepest processes around. I really love the process because it's physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, and it gives us a safe place to confront our patterns mm-hmm. on all levels and to change them. If you go into a relationship being aware of your pattern and you've actually done so. Now, when I say pattern, we're talking about that stuff we learned at home.
Sure.
And we all absorb it unconsciously. We don't even know it's there, but ooh, out it comes in a relationship. And Hoffman and the Hoffman process is brilliant at dismantling that.
Well, one of the questions I have is probably less dramatic but more deadly than some other things that create problems with couples, and that's when boredom or indifference or ennui or a stalemate comes into a relationship. Isn't it hard to get couples out of that?
I don't think it is. You know, I do a lot of relationship seminars and workshops, and one of the things I have people do is look at the three things that I feel are most important. You've got the inside investigation, which I've talked about, and then you've got a skill set. How do I actually talk about it, and how do I keep myself present, engaged, involved, noticing what's going on, growing? But then the tail of that is item number three, which I spend time on in workshops, teaching people how you do maintenance. You buy a great car, you got to do some maintenance on it.
Always.
Change the oil, not to go too far, because God knows I know nothing about maintaining cars, but you've got to work on it. I know that much. I take it into a good mechanic and get it tuned up. We have to do the same thing with our relationship. We can't park it and go, okay, now I've got it, it's in the garage, and as long as it keeps running, I don't have to do anything to keep it healthy and strong. You don't have to get bored. I actually came up with my husband's help, a concept called the GQ. And in Power Choices, we have a test at the beginning of the book to see how high your GQ is. And GQ stands for your growth quotient.
Right.
How much are you growing?
Yeah. And what I'm wondering is if the people that are in couples therapy with you privately, Ed, for instance, then can have a growth experience by coming into the seminar setting so that they can see that other people have the same problems that they have.
It's one of the most powerful things. And we say in the Hoffman process, it's done in a group, and it couldn't deliver the same outcome if it was done individually.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right.
So many ways now that we've learned today that can help couples, which hope, I think, rises eternal in everyone's heart, that the romance can come back into a relationship, a broken relationship can be healed, a single person can find someone to be in a long-term relationship with. When you're remembering our conversation from today or humming What's Love Got to Do with It, don't forget that passion is the quickest to develop and the quickest to fade. Intimacy develops more slowly and commitment more gradually still. And I want to give big appreciation to Brenda and Ed for this very rich hour and wish you all in our audience relational love that brings you happiness and fulfillment. Thank you, Brenda. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Jill.
Pleasure to be here.
I'd like to say thanks so much for listening. We want you to know that The Joan Kenley Show brings you conversation radio that's co-created for your listening pleasure with our guests. You can find out more about today's subject and how to reach our guests on my website, joankenley.com. That's K-E-N-L-E-Y, where all our shows are archived, downloadable, and podcastable 24/7. We're also on iTunes and the other top 10 podcast directories. Huge thanks go to those who made this show possible, Peter B. Collins and Christy Healy, and here in the studio, Daniel Fletcher, engineer and technical producer. This is Joan Kenley inviting you to keep listening, and we'll keep you in the conversation.